Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The United States continues to struggle with opioid addiction. Nationwide, more than 130 people die every day from an opioid overdose. And now states across the country are holding manufacturers and distributors of opioids accountable for their role in creating what they say is an epidemic. Last month, Johnson & Johnson was ordered to pay $572 million in Oklahoma, which pursued the first civil case against the drug manufacturer for causing opioid-related deaths. In October, some of the country's largest drug manufacturers and distributors will face trial in a major consolidated lawsuit made up of some 2,000 cases from municipalities across the country. The Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma, which make OxyContin, is in settlement talks and could be on the brink of filing for bankruptcy. And now, in the lead-up to the October trial, new reporting shows that as early as 2001, Johnson & Johnson were aware of how addictive their fentanyl patches actually were. Today on The Takeaway, the fight for justice and compensation from opioid manufacturers and distributors. Joining us now is Dr. Rebecca Haffagy, content lead for opioid policy at the University of Michigan Injury Prevention Center. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Julia Lurie, senior reporter at Mother Jones. Julia, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We'll start with you, Julia. The first state lawsuit, against Johnson & Johnson in Oklahoma was just a couple weeks ago. How significant was that?
It was significant in setting the tone for how future cases like this could go. So that was the first of these types of lawsuits to go to trial. And the judge effectively found Johnson & Johnson liable for helping fuel this crisis in the state of Oklahoma. The money that the state is getting as a result, the $572 million, will go towards things like addiction treatment and other services in the state of Oklahoma. And it's what the state estimates would cover about a year of services to mitigate this crisis in Oklahoma. It's way less than the $17 billion that the state was originally requesting, but still it's not nothing. And as we go into this fall with this federal case on the horizon, people are definitely speculating that the plaintiffs in this federal case will use similar arguments to the arguments that were used in Oklahoma.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was Johnson & Johnson's argument in Oklahoma, and how do we expect them to argue here in this next lawsuit?
The state alleged that Johnson & Johnson's role basically falls into two different categories. So the first is that, like many other pharmaceutical companies, Johnson & Johnson underplayed the addictive effects of its own opioids that it sold, and really heavily marketed those drugs to high-volume prescribers and overplayed the benefits of its drugs. The other allegations are more unique to Johnson & Johnson. So Johnson & Johnson, what a lot of people don't know is that they were key players in the opioid supply chain. So a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson was responsible for growing poppies in Tasmania and selling narcotics to leading drug companies, including OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma, for example. The state of Oklahoma was basically saying, you caused a public nuisance in this state by not only fueling these other drug companies, but by selling your own opioids, and you need to pay for that.
Rebecca, there is, as we mentioned, that major consolidated lawsuit going to trial in Ohio in October. How many companies are going to be involved? What are the basics here?
Yeah, so there's many companies involved, both distributors and manufacturers, and there's two plaintiffs, the counties, Cuyahoga and Summit counties of Ohio. So there are multiple claims being brought, unlike the Oklahoma trial, which really did whittle down to just what Julia had mentioned, the public nuisance claim. The trial in Ohio has both that, it has general fraud claims, it has other sort of claims under the Controlled Substances Act, the federal law. So that can bring in federal claims as well, because that is a federal trial. So it's there's much more complexity going on there, and many other ways that the various defendants could be held liable.
And we know that we've done reporting on this show about the opioid crisis in Ohio. How significant is it that this is happening in Ohio, Rebecca?
Quite significant. I mean, that's really why the multi-district litigation was consolidated there, in large part because it's the epicenter of the opioid crisis. Ohio, you know, is among the worst states, you know, depending on what year you're looking at or what measure, but among the worst states in terms of opioid harms, and really only has started those harms. The prescribing only crested in Ohio very recently, and I believe the deaths are still increasing or flat. So it's one of the worst states. So that was one reason why the trial and the overall federal litigation was consolidated there.
Julia, as we mentioned, the Sackler family, who are the owners of Purdue Pharma, who make OxyContin, and other companies are trying to settle the case before actually going to court in October. Tell us a little bit about that strategy.
Sure. So any given defendant could settle, or they could go to trial. A couple of the pharmaceutical companies have already have official settlement agreements on the table, and there's been talk of a Purdue settlement as well. On the one hand, with a settlement, the argument is that municipalities could get money faster. The whole point of this litigation is to help mitigate the effects of the crisis. So theoretically, the municipalities want to be getting money as fast as they can so that they can then, you know, apply it locally to what they need to do to deal with this crisis. And theoretically, they wouldn't have to deal with this long, drawn-out legal process that comes with a trial. On the other hand, with settlements, you could argue that there would be a lack of transparency, that the evidence that, you know, would look really bad for pharmaceutical companies and distributors and pharmacies wouldn't end up coming out. With just some of the exhibits so far, and this is before the case has even gone to trial, you're seeing things like internal emails and sales presentation and sales numbers and donations to various pain advocacy organizations that really sort of tell the story of how this opioid crisis came to be. And with a settlement, you likely wouldn't see the complexity and the complete picture of that story.
Rebecca, how useful is the approach here of taking these companies to court, and that in terms of really having an impact on the crisis, the opioid crisis across the country?
Yeah, so I believe it's a supplement to other policies. I don't think it's entirely futile. And the reason being, some of what Julia was saying, it can actually serve to bring forth important evidence so we understand how the crisis evolved, you know, how different parties might have been responsible. It serves as a deterrent as well, so that these companies and others like them, and even in other drug spaces, are deterred from engaging in some of these behaviors in the future, you know, if indeed they did fraudulently market their products, misrepresent their product's addictiveness, deliberately manipulate those aspects of opioids. So if they indeed did that, and it, you know, is looking like many did based upon the evidence that's coming forward, then we have that on the record. We have some evidence of that. We have some accountability. We have some deterrent from that happening in the future. It also, you know, the damages can, you know, I think they are starting to, and they could add up to significant amounts of money. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the federal government has given, you know, a couple billion at this point, but not anywhere near what the costs of mitigating the crisis are. And states and localities, the reason they're bringing these lawsuits is they are out of money. They do not have the money anymore to be putting towards naloxone, EMT, EMS services, treatment, all of these things that are needed to now try to, you know, repair all of the harms.
Julia, off of that point, I mean, first of all, is the money, we mentioned the Oklahoma settlement. I don't know if that's, I guess, putting in quotes here, enough to fill some of the gaps that exist right now in terms of what's needed and what actually, where the funding is. And also, who is going to oversee this money to make sure it is going to the places that it's really needed?
Yeah, as Rebecca mentioned, you know, the largely, you know, broadly speaking, the reason why these municipalities are suing, why these 2,000 some municipalities are suing, is because this crisis has not only been really devastating, but very expensive. So, you know, counties, for example, they have to foot the costs of emergency medical services and addiction treatment and foster care for kids and court and prison costs for drug users and dealers. This is an incredibly costly crisis. And so, you know, it's hard to say how much money would be enough money. In the case of the Johnson & Johnson case in Oklahoma, the state had been asking for $17 billion to cover all those costs, and that would cover those costs theoretically for the next 20 years. They ended up coming out with about a year's worth of money to cover the costs of the crisis.
Rebecca, have we heard anything from the 2020 Democratic candidates about their plan for this issue and just the broader issue of opioid addiction in the United States?
Yeah, so the most prominent proposal would be that the CARE Act, which has been proposed, was proposed in 2018 by Senator Warren and Eli Cummings, and Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris have also come out in support of that bill. So that bill would put, to my earlier point of we really don't have the money, and even the federal government hasn't put the appropriate or adequate amounts forward. This bill would get closer to where we need to be. So that the bill would put $100 billion over 10 years towards the opioid crisis, largely in terms of addiction treatment, but also other social supports. And that's more along the line of what most estimates nationally say the crisis is costing. It's a lot more. It's more like, you know, $100 billion per year are some of the, you know, estimates. It depends on what you include in the cost. But at least that bill would get us quite a bit closer to the magnitude of money we need.
Dr. Rebecca Haffagy is content lead for opioid policy at the University of Michigan Injury Prevention Center. And Julia Lurie is a senior reporter at Mother Jones. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.